You are listening to another Screenfish One-on-One, this time live with director Madeline Olnick. With her latest film, Madeline brings to life famed author Emily Dickinson with a unique tone. Whereas most people picture Dickinson as a recluse who hides from the world, Olnick shows us another side of her life that was filled with vibrancy and romance as she speaks into a culture that vastly needs to hear her voice. In this one-on-one, we speak to Madeline about what it is about Dickinson's poetry that is so relevant for today, and what it is about the power of words that she understood that others didn't at the time. Welcome to the conversation. Welcome to Screenfish. Hi, Madeline. How are you?
Good. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. Thank you so much for talking with me. I appreciate it.
I'm so happy to.
I saw Wild Nights with Emily, and I mean, this is a really fascinating story. How did you come to be associated with the film?
Well, I actually, years ago, when I first read this article in the New York Times, this was like 1998, in 1999, I made a play version of it.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And of course, that was long ago. I always knew I wanted to make it into a movie, but before that happened, I had to become a filmmaker. And I had a couple of, this is my third feature film. So I wrote a screenplay, and in the time between the play version and the film version, even more research came out. For people who maybe don't know some of the story, it's basically we all think of Emily Dickinson as this recluse who didn't leave her room and no one loved her and she hid her poems away and talked to people through walls and was morbid. And actually, she had a lifelong romantic relationship with this woman who eventually married her brother, and her brother had a mistress who was the person who put together Emily's books of poetry after Emily's death and spun the story of Emily as this tortured person. So more information, research and stuff came out between the two stories. I didn't know, for example, that the mistress would go and visit, would have her dates with Emily's brother at Emily's house. I didn't know that when I wrote the play. I knew that they were having an affair, but that wasn't a piece of information that was widely known at that point. And that was really, like, if you've ever been to the house in Amherst, there's no way she couldn't have heard what was going on. And in fact, a lot of the reason she didn't leave her room was when they were there. You know, Mabel, who was the mistress, who would talk to audiences and, oh, Emily never left her room, of course, wasn't saying to audiences, the only reason I was at her house was because I was going there to meet Emily's brother, for sex, so this very famous story of, oh, this woman went to Emily's house for 3 years and Emily never came out of her room, like, had this totally different context that we never understood. And I thought that was so fascinating how, people often don't think about so much of history comes from the perspective of the person who's telling it. Everyone always assumes the person telling the story is this, reputable person with no ulterior motive. And even if you see, even as recently as, like, I think it was like 1980s, you could see this special on PBS, which is our public, the television channel here in the States, where they read this letter from Mabel Todd, that's Austin Dickinson's mistress, Emily's brother's mistress, and describing, like, I'd go to play the piano at the house and Emily would sit listening from the other room and send me a poem that she would compose as she listened to me. And And that, and then Channel 13 was like, that was the voice of a young faculty member at Amherst College. It was like, it wasn't the voice of a young faculty member. That was Austin Dickinson's mistress making up a story because she went to have sex at her. They had their rendezvous there because they couldn't have them at his house. And she also was married. So they had to go somewhere, and they went to Emily's house. Emily and her sister Lavinia's house. So, that was, it just was so funny, you know, to put that all, figure that, you know.
Well, that, you know, and that was one of the things that I noticed, too. You mentioned about it, that even that instance being funny. The film is funny. It's not what I expected at all. You know, I was wondering how you crafted that tone and how Molly Shannon got to be involved. That I would not have expected her to play Dickinson, but she does a wonderful job.
It was my dream to have her play the part. I think that for anyone who has seen her performances on Saturday Night Live and other movies and other people, that movie where she won an Independent Spirit Award, where she plays a mother dying of cancer, you know, understands that she has that range where she can play both really, really funny comedy and great. And she's a great dramatic actress as well. And the thing that people don't, another thing that's been revised about Emily Dickinson was actually she had a great sense of humor and was very funny. Mm. And that was the last, like, when I found that out, too, I was like, oh, that's one more thing that's been kept from us. When I was in my 20s, I used to joke that I wanted to be the Emily Dickinson of comedy. And the joke was that, you know, she was the most miserable person in the world, you know, with no sense of humor. And then I found out not only were all these other things not true about her, but she also was very funny. And her niece talked about how, you know, no one would talk longer or funnier than Aunt Emily, that she just would just. Was really, really funny. Had a great sense of humor, and there's laugh out loud things she's written and said. And I thought, like, wow, like, this is one more way in which, you know, Emily Dickinson has been made into this weird figure, almost like a female punishment story. Mm. You know, one of the things in literature, in 19th century literature and novels, it used to be that if a female heroine had any kind of independence, like something horrible would happen to her, like she'd be beheaded or thrown from a horse or, you know, like she'd be punished for the independence that she took, you know, whereas with Emily Dickinson, you know, she came pre-punished. You know what I mean? Like, we are all told, okay, she was a brilliant poet, but she never left her room. No one loved her. She was scared to talk to people. She hid her papers. She didn't want her poems published. Like, all these things which weren't, like, just of a miserable wretch, kind of. Mm. So it's like, okay, she was a genius, but who would want to be that? Who would want to live like that?
You know, thinking of Dickinson, I mean, there's a wonderful line where, you know, she's talking with her girlfriend, and she says, and the girlfriend says, which I can't think of her name. What was her name again?
Susan.
Thank you.
Susan,
yes.
She was Susan Gilbert, and then ultimately she became Susan Dickinson in many different ways. But anyway.
Yes.
Yes, and with.
And Susan says, who are you going to be reading in 100 years? Whitman and right. You. And so here's my question. Why are we still reading Dickinson? Why are we still so fascinated with her?
Well, one of the things that's one of the greatest compliments the movie gets paid to my mind is I'm told often two things. One, people say to me, I never thought I would go see an Emily Dickinson movie, you know, any movie about Emily Dickinson. And the second thing they say is, after they've seen it, I want to run home and read more Emily Dickinson poems. Mm. Because I feel like we're still, one of the things that I like, and everyone has their own thing that they like about Dickinson's poetry, but to me, as someone who's a dramatist, you know, my main interest is in psychology, like human psychology, how people think about things, how they act. And Emily Dickinson's poems, they're so modern, and often she's capturing and communicating truths about psychological states before there was a field of psychology that had even defined them. And they are just so modern that they're shocking. And, for example, there's a poem in there. The first line is, pain has an element of blank.
Yeah.
And anyone who's ever been in any kind of emotional pain knows the truth of that line. What's funny is in real life, one of the things Mabel did, Mabel is Emily Dickinson's brother's mistress. When she put the poems together, she slapped titles on them. Hmm. And on that poem, she slapped the title, The Mystery of Pain. Like it was like a mystery or something. Like it totally, you know, kind of changing the meaning. And then she also took liberties and changed words she didn't like. And in that poem in particular, adding things to her periods of pain, making it a poem where you were looking at a woman as opposed to a poem where everyone's inside of it experiencing it along with the poem. Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, I hear what you're saying. Here's a question, too, since we're talking about this. Is there something that Dickinson understood about the power of words that others didn't at the time? Like, there is that exchange she has where she's discussing what poetry is. And it just seems to be completely lost on the people she's talking to. But she's so sure.
Yes, I do think that's a very good point. There was something. I mean, there were two forces at work. One was obviously she was the woman writing the kind of poetry that women weren't supposed to write. There may have been a little bit of overlap in the sense with Walt Whitman, but Walt Whitman, because, you know, he wasn't expected to adhere to traditional notions of femininity, had more leeway and he had more options to push the form. And in fact, Emerson, when he had read the draft of Leaves of Grass, had suggested that Walt Whitman cut this chunk of it that was going to be more controversial, and Whitman refused and could do that because he had more options and more ways to get it out there. Mm-hmm. So he could get his poems out there the way that he wanted them to, written the way that he wrote them. And think about how this was a time where women didn't even have the right to vote.
Yeah.
I think that Emily Dickinson came from, I do think she had a brilliant mind. Here's something I want to quote that just startled me. And this is not a word for word quote, because it was an idea I can relay that really startled me. And it startled me because it was so well put, and it was written in 1951, this book that was published about Emily and this woman, Kate, who she had a brief affair with, that also appears in the movie.
Mm-hmm.
But the scholar who was writing in 1951 and this book, and I want to talk about that book in a second, but it talked about how because Emily Dickinson was involved in this unorthodox romantic situation, it necessarily caused her to question the arbitrariness of all social conventions.
Hmm.
Does that make sense?
Yes, yeah.
And because she was, yeah, that it made her, and I was like, wow, that is so well put for someone in the 1950s to have realized that. That because she loved this woman and she wasn't supposed to, because, I mean, there were things, when she was younger, she actually was supposed to wash and mend Austin's clothes.
Mm.
You know, why was she why did she have to? I read what's, I'm like free associating here, but, you know, Anne Frank in the annex, she had a writing desk, but when the dentist joined them all in the annex, Anne Frank was forced to share her desk with the dentist. It was like, right. What did the dentist paint the desk for? like she was a writer. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
She needed that desk as a producer. She was a writer. So that was something that put her, that totally put her out of her time and space. Having to grapple with that, knowing something in her heart that was so true, and that there wasn't anything, you know, that feeling and these feelings and understanding that you were told you weren't supposed to feel this way, and then looking around the rest of the world and it's like, well, what else am I not, you know, am I not supposed to be doing, you know? So, yeah, so that I do think advantaged her. In a way, as difficult as the struggle as it must have been at the time, and I feel like I've sat and grappled with, you know, what must that have been like to have found herself in love with actually several different women at different points in her life, and nowhere, couldn't go on the internet, there was no, like, gay pride parade, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, she had no way to come to terms with it except to think about it and to read and look for examples in literature.
Yeah. It's a fascinating look at gender identity and sexuality in a time when it was, and I use this term loosely, clearly defined. And I don't necessarily mean that it was, you know, correct. That's not what I'm saying. But I'm saying, you know, it was, the roles were sort of forced upon, if I'm saying that properly, or this is the way that it is.
Yeah.
So having said that, is there anything in particular that you think that really Dickinson speaks to today? Like you said, she's so modern and she didn't have these opportunities. So what is it about her that continues to make her relevant to what women of this generation, certainly LGBT, like what is it about her?
She takes you inside of the poem.
Hmm.
And you have an experience within it. And that's something we tried really hard. One of the reasons we made this movie have such a different kind of experience than a normal biopic is I feel the failure of literary biopics is quite often you just know, you leave knowing a few more details about that writer's life, but you've never experienced the thrill of their language and ideas. And I wanted people to experience the poems as opposed to just listen to them. So we tried to make each poem a different experience. And some of them were, say, if you were having a dream in the 1800s, what would that dream be like? And for some of the poems. And so that was really important to me. And elaborate a little more on that question, if you may.
No, I just wonder, I think what you're saying is wonderful, and I think with the use of her own poetry, it does draw you into her mind more than just creating a character. You're actually letting her speak in her own voice. I guess my comment was, or my question was more related to the fact of, you know, what is it about the content of her message that resonates so powerfully today with you know, as you said before, she's got very modern ideas for the time she was in, modern for today. So what is it that was so modern and speaks to our culture at this time?
Well, I think what often binds people to a certain time period is an acceptance of all the conventions of that time.
Hmm.
So since she eschewed conventions, she has a no shelf date. You know, like, for example, Helen Hunt Jackson, who was a poet who was the most famous female poet in America, we have her have a cameo in our movie. You understand how she was writing about very conventional concerns about women at that time,
right,
you know, that they had, and very traditional notions of femininity. Someone now, like, let's say a writer now who's writing about whether or not to get Botox, you know, for a woman or plastic surgery, like 100 years from now, that's not going to be as relevant. You know, I can only hope that, you know, those kinds of concerns aren't, you know, that were something that was just a sign of where we were as a society now, where so much of a woman, how she is perceived, is based on her appearance, her value. So it's about what makes Emily Dickinson timeless was that her insights were timeless and her concerns were timeless. They're about the human condition. And I think that, again, we've been surprised by two things. One, that men like the movie, love the movie as much as our female audiences. And secondly, that the movie really appeals to senior citizens. And I was surprised. I mean, normally, as someone who has made plays and movies for 30 years now, I always feel like I know who the audience is. Like, people say, do you know your audience? I'm like, yeah, I know who my audience is and all that. And then we went to the Sarasota Film Festival, and they had three screenings because it was so popular among seniors. And I had this 95-year-old woman stay out with me until 1 a.m. just telling me how much she loved the movie, and we had sell out crowds. And I realized a couple things. Like, one, the obvious things. One, it's hard to even find a movie without violence. You know, that's not right, like a loud barrage of things. But this is a movie, there is beautiful music in it, beautiful costumes, beautiful poetry that appears on screen. And it's a beautiful story, a beautiful love story, tastefully done between yeah, these two women. And there really isn't a lot for senior citizens to see. So this is a kind of a movie that you can go with your parents, with your grandparents. We've had people bring their high school age children to it. And it's because, again, the poems are so strong that it's a quality. I mean, I wish I could say my writing is so brilliant that everyone loves it, but, you know, Emily Dickinson's poems are so amazing. And also because it's entertaining. Like, we have some really, really heavy hitters in the world of comedy. We have Molly Shannon, obviously, and Brett Gelman, who's on several Netflix shows, Kevin Seal, who's hilarious. We have all these really, really funny performers in it, so that it's entertaining as well.
Yeah, it's a great film. It really is, Madeline. I really appreciate you taking the time to talk with me, and thank you so much. It's really brought a lot of insight to a woman that, you know, I do like how you phrased that before about, you know, we've sort of got this picture in our mind of what her life was like, but in fact, we've been twisting it all this time based on one person's narrative. Right. And I think that's right, really appropriate. So thank you so much, Madeline. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks so much. Have a great day.
You too. This was wonderful. Thank you so much.
Bye-bye.